because in the old days, in the very beginning, some of those rubber duck antennas inside had nichrome wire, and the reason for that is because they wanted to have broadband impedance match for multi-bands, and whether or not the rubber duck ran efficient or inefficient, having low standing wave ratio was more important, they thought. Well, amateurs started making measurements and found out, and they started voting with their pocketbook, and now all those rubber ducks are made out of a copper-coated or a copper wire inside. So you can do that experiment if you want, Joe. It is my gut feel for all the antenna work I've done that you're only going to get a fraction of a dB improvement, because what you've got there is really not bad. When let me drop...
No comment?
I know there's another person who want to make a comment. Please stand by a second. Whenever we walk around with our handy-talkies, in other words, you and I might both have a 5-watt handy-talkie, and we want to find out what is the range. So I stand in front of my house, and you start walking down the street. And you find out by the time you walk a mile or two, the walkie-talkie to walkie-talkie communication is starting to become marginal because of earth curvature, trees, buildings, all the stuff that's in between. That exact same handy-talkie, in the case of a Motorola handy-talkie, used by astronaut Owen Garriott on the space shuttle when he was over northern Texas, 1,500 miles away from me. That handy-talkie with the antenna in the window of the space shuttle upside down gave me a near-dead full quieting signal in Huntington. So it isn't the power coming out of the radio, the handy-talkie that's the problem. It's the environment in between. That's the reason why we're all repeater users, because we're talking to something that's on a high location that gets around that problem. So, as I said, lots of people have the opinion that a rubber duck is a low-efficiency antenna. In my opinion, it is not. Who is the person who wanted to add a comment? Give us your call letters and your name. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
2YO, Bernie.
You got it, Bernie. Wait for the beep.
Slight adjustment to the answer I would make is in certain applications. Back during the Northridge earthquake, I was stationed up above Northridge up in the hills, and at my position, I had an HT that I had clipped onto a shelf bracket that was on one frequency. I was using a mobile unit elsewhere. That HT did not have a counterpoise at that point, and I was using a speaker mic on it. And so it was losing range because it did not have a counterpoise. In that case, where you have, say, an HT with a speaker mic, and the HT is not going to be, shall we say, coupled to your body, then I believe that a counterpoise is used. But at the rest of the time, when you're holding it, I agree with you absolutely that your body is the counterpoise. There was actually an interesting article in QST. It was probably 20, 25 years ago. I forget where I ran across it, but they actually found some directionality based on your body holding an HT to your mouth. Actually provided some directionality that you had more signal moving in the direction you were facing than behind you.
Yeah, Don, good information, Bernie. Your body certainly makes a difference. Talk to any of the guys that have done some serious fox hunting. When they get very close to the fox, they take off the rubber duck so that they're starting to hear the signal that leaks directly into the package, because they're so close they need some attenuation. And then by holding the rubber duck, or holding the handy-talkie in front of their chest and rotating their body, so to speak, with the handy-talkie, staying fixed compared to their body, the front-to-back ratio of a human being with that signal coming into the handy-talkie without the rubber duck probably has at least a 6 or a 10 dB front-to-back ratio. There's another thing going on here, Bernie. When you provided that ground plane by way of the metal shelf and you saw an improvement, I strongly believe you did see that improvement and it was real, but there's another thing happening. Let me drop.
Oh, negative. There was no ground plane from the shelf.
Then what was the shelf doing?
There was just a bracket there that I could use to hang the HD on. I put the clip of the HD on it just so it wouldn't land on the desk.
Well done. And therefore, as long as you found that it was working to the repeater in that fixed location, now at least for continuous communication, what frequently happens is a guy is in a marginal location with his handy-talkie, and as the person talks, his body is going to be moving, he's going to be walking around the room, and even if he thinks he's sitting still in a chair, he sometimes swivels the chair and so on, and the signal could be going in and going out. I'm in a place that is, 20 miles from this particular repeater, and there's a lot of stuff in between me and it. I live in an area that's got 85-foot high trees, and there's miles of them around in Huntington where I live. As such, when I hold my handy-talkie in my living room or in my bathroom, I can move it up and down, left and right, forward and back, tilt it in various directions, and I'll find a whole lot of places where the signal is pretty good and a whole lot of places where the signal drops out. In my bathroom, for instance, I get the best reception of this repeater. Let me drop. 6 dBZ. DBZ recognized. I get the best reception when the handy-talkie is laying horizontal on a plastic shelf in my bathroom, even though this is a known very vertical repeater. So when the signal, all radio signals experience a tremendous amount of multipath that's not obvious. Once you transmit a radio signal, I'm not kidding when I say it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. In some of those places, the signal is very weak. It never really goes to zero. It becomes extremely weak, and all that's left to discuss is whether or not it's above the threshold of the equipment you're using to receive the signal in that location. That signal going from point A to point B is bouncing off of everything in the environment. There's a million paths almost always present, and all those paths get added together in a vector voltage manner at the receiving antenna. So as you move the antenna, as you move the handy-talkie around, some of those paths are becoming longer, some of them becoming shorter, some of them going into the right polarization, some of them in the wrong polarization. So when you're in a marginal location, you'll find all kinds of ways of changing the orientation and making the signal get better and worse. And you have to be careful about another thing. Just because, let me drop, that signal going from point... Just because you've made the signal sound good when you're receiving doesn't mean it's going to be good when you transmit. The 600 kc of deviation, the 600 kc of difference between a transmit frequency and a receive frequency will sometimes drive you crazy. You're in a marginal location, you find a great position and way of holding the handy-talkie where you're getting great reception, and you keep holding it in that position, and then you make a transmission. The transmission is 600 kc lower, and because there's a zillion wavelengths between you and that repeater, and all of those millions of multipaths are now adding up in a slightly different manner at the transmit frequency, you can easily get the situation where they don't hear you when you transmit from that location. And if you move it to a place where you just barely hear them on reception, they may hear you beautifully when you transmit back. So as you can see, radio propagation is a little bit strange at times. Now, one of the guys that's resolved all of that strangeness is Hal, K6DBZ. You got it, Hal, K2RAW. The transmission is 600 kc lower. Yes, sir, now.
WTechNet K6DBZ. Now, Nick, could you just repeat the question that was asked? I am in the knock-this-off frequency, so I didn't get it. I'm mobile. And maybe I can throw my 2 cents in for what it's worth. Go ahead.
1YDY with a comment when you're done. Hank recognized. Yeah, it was Joe, W2BMP, who asked the original question, which was given to him by his students, and that is, if you take something like a Baofeng and add extra ground plane wires to it, would you make a significant improvement in transmission and reception? So it's adding a ground plane to a handy-talkie like a Baofeng. And my suggestion was that the improvement is going to be kind of small, and just by moving it around to the right location, I mean, when it comes to making a VHF antenna work really well, you know the three things that make it work well: altitude, altitude, and altitude. Just by choosing the right position to be using a handy-talkie can make a huge improvement or detriment. And adding ground plane wires to it, I think, is an interesting experiment. Don't not do it because I said not to do it, but I think my prediction is you're not going to get a huge improvement. I predicted only a dB or two at best, but maybe you've got another opinion on that one, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RAW in the TechNet. Moving it around.
RAW, K6DPZ. Well, the only thing I can say is if you add a 19-inch wire, or if you use a mic cord with, you know, not the mic on the radio, but a plug-in microphone, and the cord hangs down below the radio, you're going to have more of a counterpoise effect. You're going to get a little more radiation. But the difference in the radiation, as you said, Nick, would not be that much. It's still where you're located reference to where the receiving equipment is. Go ahead, Chuck.
As I see it, Joe, you've got a beautiful possible experiment that you can issue as a challenge to your students in that class. They've asked a darn good question. And the number of people with enough radio experience that can give a quantitative answer to this is very small. I might not be one of them. I'm giving you an opinion. I mean, I've been using a vector network analyzer for 10 solid years, day in and day out, doing antenna designs at 915 megacycles. 146 megs is not quite that far away. So I'm giving you an opinion that I'm not going to see a great improvement. However, I think you could send that out as a challenge to that student. Why not do it? It doesn't cost a lot of money. It's not a great big investment of time and dollars to do it. And how you quantify the result is going to be a little bit difficult to explain. But when students have that kind of curiosity, you certainly don't want to squelch it. You want to emphasize it. My point of view, Joe.
Thanks very much, Dick. I'm going to try a couple of experiments and see how we do it, and I'll report back to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks to everybody with comments. Thanks for all your help. Back to you, Dick. W2BNP, we're going to be clear.
Real fast, can I make a comment to him?
And Y2H with a comment also.
We got five people trying to make comments. The one that was way back that I didn't pick up and I'm supposed to is KC2WGB. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. You also have Hank Wheaton in wings, too. I have an answer for Joe if he wants to try it. I've made the test. I took a very thin washer, the type that's used on a quarter-inch bone plug. When you mount it to the chassis, they have washers on them. You take one of those washers, put it under the thread-in connector for the antenna. You solder a piece of wire. I used a 20-inch piece of wire. And you were right, Dick. The gain I measured that was fairly consistent was about maybe 3/4 of a dB, roughly in that area. And that was under a full span of about 10 channels on 2 meters. And it was a fun test, but it improved it, but not worth the effort, I don't think. But that's something you could try.
And to the guys that are listening, I'd recommend that you guys take at your leisure QRZ.com and type in the call letters KC2WGB, the guy you just heard from, and look at those photographs of the equipment in his laboratory. Arguably, his is the best electronic laboratory you and I can find on the East Coast of the United States that's not run by some corporation like Agilent or Hewlett-Packard. So it's with that kind of instrumentation that John is making these measurements. Hank, I think, was the next one. N1YDY, if I got you right. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, K2RIW here is N1YDY. And I just wanted to comment that in the mid to late 90s, I used to operate 2-meter aeronautical mobile out of the MD-80s I was flying. And if you had a long enough trip and everything was story, I would take a... I had an Iezu FT-530 at the time, and I would operate out of the one of the two non-heated windows. The forward-facing windows in the aircraft had heating elements that made them fairly opaque to radio waves, but the two aftermost windows in the cockpit were not heated in any way, and I would put a rubber duck from the HT-530 in the window, and I could operate. I could regularly hit... between 108 to 190 miles when I was flying at 35 to 37,000 feet. The theoretical limit is about 220 miles using the limit that they've given us and for aeronautical stations, and I never quite got to that. But the line of sight was the big thing. You obviously couldn't operate, or I did operate about half a watt, which is the lowest that aircraft, that radio would transmit. Let me drop it for a second. But the best reception, not reception, but the best transmission that I got in terms of quality signal on the ground, I got when I did something similar to what John was talking about. I had a, it wasn't a phono washer, but I had a washer that I soldered a little wire to, and on the other end of the wire an alligator clip, and I would put the alligator clip to the frame of the aircraft. Obviously, would drive against that. And that that worked significantly better than just having the rubber duck by itself sitting in the windshield in terms of having the maximum distance that I could have a QSO with. And one whitey one.
See if he said still is confident.
Okay, that's a beautiful experiment you did, Bill. I mean, yeah, it's Hank. Did you see any directionality? In other words, if you were transmitting to a station that was directly forward, east of you, west of you, so to speak, did you see evidence of an antenna pattern that you were creating from the place that you were transmitting from? Back to you, Hank, K2RAW.
Absolutely, it's highly directional. It was 90 degrees to the left of the direction the aircraft was flying. I was in the left seat up front, and, you know, it basically would transmit out that window, sort of almost like a flashlight pattern. So I had the best range, 90 degrees to the left of the aircraft, or if you want to be technical, about 270 degrees, you know, from the nose of the aircraft, in terms of directionality.
And by the way, you were transmitting to repeaters, or were you running simplex with people? And I think you said this was on 2 meters. Back to you, Hank.
I found repeater operation was almost impossible. I keyed up so many repeaters, even without PL, that it just didn't work. I tried transmitting on the output frequency of certain repeaters, and that would work somewhat better. You know, I would just use simplex and transmit on the output. But the best was using 520 simplex. The 440 stuff worked just as well. There just weren't as many operators for me to catch. You know, as soon as I threw out that aeronautical mobile call, I had a lot of meters. It was for a period of time. I couldn't do this long. I had, you know, duties in the airplane. So, you know, I would operate for perhaps 15, 20 minutes at a pop, and, you know, then I would have to go back to work. But, you know, essentially it was 2 meters of what I used on 520.
Well done, Hank. And my experience tells me that single sideband has almost 10 decibels more sensitivity than FM, although it's a much more difficult equipment problem than setting up the frequencies and so on. So had you done that on sideband, boy, would you be getting some range. We got both, I think both Mike and Hal. Hal, K6DPZ, go ahead with your comment.
Before I go, I have one more comment.
Go ahead, Hank.
The aircraft themselves, some of the aircraft had an HF rig built in if they were designed or had been equipped for international operations, for overseas international operations. And the older one actually works better because it would allow you to operate up even into the 10-meter band. The newer ones were very frequency-specific and would only operate in improved aeronautical bands. But in the MD-80 DC-9 aircraft, they use the whole aircraft as the ground, and the HF antenna is built into the fiberglass tail cone. Not as directional as using FM, but obviously much greater range. So if you had the Collins, I think it was a 518P, I believe. I can't remember what the suffix was, but there was a Collins radio, a 518. And if you had the 518, you could operate in the aircraft without doing any, you know, any mods. You simply dialed in the amateur frequency you wanted, and obviously if you had a license throughout your call sign, could operate that way. And it did do much better on single sideband than the FM did out the window. And I'm done. N1 whitey white.
EPZ, you used the 618T, which I'm very familiar with.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to do that. 518 or 618T. Tell us about that and your other comment. K6DPZ, K2RAW, you got it, Hal.
RAW, K6DPZ. 618T, 2 to 30 megahertz transceiver SSB. Very fine transceiver, as a matter of fact. I've repaired many of them for small airlines. It's a great radio, and they have a tuner that uses mounted in the tail. And you could, on HF, single sideband, they're phenomenal. Okay, my comment is, if you want to see how well your antenna experiment works, set yourself a field strength meter and set a given distance away and check the relative field strength. Hold on. And if you want to really be accurate in doing a field strength meter measurement, build a field strength meter, put an attenuator in front of the field strength meter, calibrated step attenuator, and you see how many dBs difference you're reading with using a ground counterpoise and not a ground counterpoise. That's my comment. Kilowatts, delta, papa, zulu.
No, sir. Yeah, it's a good way of doing quantitative measurement, but you got to be a little bit careful with that, because almost any measurement we're likely to make is going to be getting the direct path through air and at least one major reflection off the ground. And as you take the emitting device or the receiving device, the field strength meter, and raise and lower each one a few inches in altitude, you'll see a significant difference in signal strength because of the ground bounce versus the direct path going in phase and out of phase with each other. When you add the ground plane, quite often, or when you add the piece of wire hanging down that was part of the speaker mic or whatever, quite often the phase center of emission is shifting to a new altitude and you'll get a new signal strength. Is the new signal strength because of the new place of emitting, or is it because of real increased antenna gain? As you can see, there's a little bit of ambiguity. Unless you're in a perfect anechoic chamber, to get quantitative measurements out of this, it's got a couple of difficulties. Don't let that be a showstopper, but know ahead of time you are walking into a slightly difficult, not quite minefield, as far as quantifying whether or not the antenna A is better than antenna B. These guys that do shootouts of all kinds of antennas in a parking lot are running into some of these problems, if you know what I mean. Who's the other person who want to make a comment? I think Mike was one of them. Let me go to Mike first. N1MJM, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Mike.
You put a counterpoise on a field strength meter, so your sizes of counterpoise are the same, then you take your relative readings.
Nope, it wasn't me, Dick.
Okay.
Hey, you have a question, but go ahead.
Who's the person? All right. Is there any other person with a comment on this particular subject that's on the table right now? Give me a call at us right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Negatory. It's contrary to what you're talking about. It was a question I wanted to ask, but I see you guys are in a conversation about aircraft or whatever. So I can wait till later on to answer this question. KC2UJL.
Yeah, Dick, it's NY2H. I had a comment, but you alluded to it just before the speaker mic and what effects that might have on any of this.
Okay, we're going to pick up Lou and then UJL in that order. Lou, what's your experience with speaker mic changing the apparent phase center of emission or reception, therefore adding or subtracting a speaker mic, even though you think you've put the handy talkie in the exact same location, really does give you a different altitude of signal, if you know what I mean. And therefore, the way the signals add and subtract between point A and point B can change in mysterious ways. I bet you've seen a little bit of that, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and I've done the thing with the clip leads, et cetera. But Bernie's story, he was using the external speaker mic, and, you know, it's some length of wire. And I would think that that's also acting as a counterpoise. It's got a ground lead in it, so just wanted to throw that in. But you did kind of mention it about 2 minutes ago, so there you go. And that's all, NY2H.
Question? Okay, before we go over to Tony, who's the person with a question?
KC2RFN, just a aviation radio question.
Go ahead, Alan.
Are there any technical or legal problems with me using a handheld 2-meter radio up in the Cessna 172?
You got it, Hank. N1YGY, K2RIW, and TechNet. That's your area.
K2RIW, N1YGY. Here's the deal. The way the law is written, FAR is written, the pilot in command is capable. Well, let me stop. The operator is the way it says. The operator is considered to be capable of proving the use of PEDs, which are portable electronic devices, as long as they don't interfere with, as long as he's made the determination that they don't interfere with the navigation or communication of the aircraft. And for the purposes of private pilot operation, the word operator and pilot and command are essentially the same. Let me drop it. 1YDY, but for the purposes of doing it with an airline, the word operator actually translates to, you know, the company, the named company, the certificate holder. So the airline would have to approve it if you wanted to do it in, say, you know, a Delta airline. Most airline operations, Delta specifically, American specifically, I would say, you know, almost 99 out of 100, operators don't allow the pilot in command of a commercial jet to make that determination. At the time when I was doing it, I was in management at the company, and I actually wrote our TON in such a way that the man could make that determination for his particular flight. I got away with it. There was a change in management. I came in and writing that particular like promote, made his changes and everybody, so it's no longer a company that I used to work for. But if you're a private pilot situation, the way the FAR is written, you know, the PIC can do it, can make the determination. And 1YDY.
PC with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Where's it go? PIC. Takes the phase rig, flying, playing with death. Somebody else in the right seat can play with the radio, but the PIC should have head and his mind on what he's doing. That's my comment.
Yeah, we got to be careful with a distracted driver, so to speak. And when it comes to using portable radio electronics on a commercial airliner, I think you can say safely that most of the time it's not allowed. From what I understand, from what Hank is telling us, the pilot is not allowed to make that decision, even though I've heard a couple of cases where the pilot did. It's really the owner of the aircraft, so to speak. And so looks like we're pushing our luck on that one. Okay, Tony, KC2UJL, you've just bubbled to the top of our list, and you're allowed to ask your question. Go ahead, Tony, K2LIW in the TechNet.
One side. K2R... K2R2, you say you call kind of quick. I think it's been a long time since me and you had, we talked. But I had a question to ask that's perpendicular to everything you guys are talking about out there. But I was on the radio last night. And, you know, when I open up my station, listen to me carefully now. I got a notebook and I open a new page. I put a date, the time, and the amount of watts I'm using on my radio, and the day at the top of the page that I log in on my station. I've been doing that since I've been an AM operator. Somebody told me, well, you know, you don't got to do that no more. Well, whatever you don't have to do, I don't care. But the FCC, when I took my test, said that when you turn your radio on, you got to keep a log of how much wattage you're using, what frequency you're operating on, and who you're talking to, and the time that you're finished and you sign off the frequency. Can you please correct that for me?
Very fine, Tony. KC2UJL. I'm K2RIW, Real Indian Woman. Without a doubt, you're right. When you and I first got our license, the logging requirements were pretty stiff. Also, the location of transmission was something that had to be kept track of. In other words, in theory, in 1956 when I got my license, if you did a portable operation, you drove down to Florida, you were supposed to tell the FCC, supposed to send them a letter telling them how long you're going to be in Florida. And your logbook had to represent all of that. And we also had some strict requirements with reference to Morse code capability. As you can tell, Tony, a lot of that has been relaxed. There's no longer a Morse code requirement. There's no longer a requirement to tell them ahead of time that you're going to be operating a portable from a new location. And when it comes to the logging, it appears to me from everything I know, that the logging requirement has been dropped. Particularly when it comes to channelized, quick back and forth type operations like we do on 2 meters. I mean, if you're in the middle of a net of people on 2 meters, and 25 people sign in, by the old rules, you'd have to write down all 25 people that you were in CUSO with on that round table, if you know what I mean. As you can tell, it can start getting, with modern day equipment, it can start getting complicated pretty fast. To my knowledge, there no longer is any logging requirement. I'd like the people listening to my voice to correct me on that. So if you know whether or not there is a logging requirement, I mean, Tony, you're doing the right thing for you and I to keep our Morse code capability, to keep our logging, our logs up to date. It serves us as a kind of a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a diary. It's a great piece of instrumentation, a documentation you can use at various times to find out is the antenna changing and so on. There's a lot of reasons that you and I would enjoy continuing to log, but I don't think it's an FCC requirement anymore. You guys out there can correct me on that. Please give me your call letters and name if you guys comment on this subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I just wanted to say one more thing and I'll be out of your way. Dick, that's the way I operate my station. And when I was with the Kings County Radio Club and we had a QRP, a 1 watt club, everything was done according to the rule books. Whatever they have now, I really don't care. I'll be very honest with you, they should have never taken the code out of the licensing, because if they would have left the code in the licensing, we wouldn't have all the baloney we got on the radio today, all the problems we have out there. You know, you understand what I'm talking about, I'm pretty sure of that. But what can I tell you? If the test was a little harder to take, people that couldn't pass it, didn't deserve to be on the radio, it would be a lot better. That's my answer to that question. What can I say? Thank you very much, Dick, for your time.
Well, you've got the right idea, Tony. Back in the days when the license requirement was a little bit more stringent, it was a little more selective, and a person really had to prove that he was interested in the hobby before he was given a license. I think in the United Kingdom, until recently, you had to be a shortwave listener for a certain period of time before you could even apply for a license. And yes, we've relaxed the rules. However, you and I would like to believe that nobody's going to transmit without a license. Some of the people that do illegal things are doing it without a license. So whether or not we have more restrictive testing procedures so that a person gets the license that way is not necessarily a gating item anymore. Unfortunately, people can go out with no license, buy almost any radio equipment, and they could, if they were foolish enough, go out there for at least a period of time and make a real nuisance of themselves without a license. It's the sign of the times. And so we have to become more skilled with fox hunting and other similar techniques. We have to clean up our own nest, if you know what I mean. The FCC has limited resources in order to do all the law enforcement for us. We've got to do an awful lot of that work ourselves. It's not a pleasant subject, but that's part of what I think is going on. Anybody with any further comments on this subject, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
IDY with a comment.
You've got it, Hank.
And I agree with a lot of what the gentleman just said, but unfortunately I don't believe that that's the nature of gatekeeping. The nature of gatekeeping is that the cost of equipment has become so low relative to the value of the dollar that people pick things up at, flea markets and things like that, and then they get on the radio that way. The other comment I wanted to make is how put something out about flying. I don't want anyone to think that at any time I operated the amateur radio equipment when I was not the non-flying pilot, and there was not plenty of time to do it. So like Hal said, you know, the guy in the right seat can look out the window. Well, airline flying, swap seats, swap turns, flying the aircraft. So at no time was I a pilot in command when I was making the flights. In one way, anyway.
Good point, Hank. And so you sound like a responsible person. And we have good reason to believe you didn't do something irresponsibly. I think I've gone down the whole list of people who signed in who did have a question or a comment for the first section of the TechNet. Let me make sure I didn't forget anybody because I got sloppy writing here. K2LIW listening. Good. Kind of thought so. It's time for the mailbag. And boy, are we late. Our schedule is a little bit on the loose side, as you can tell. Sometimes we get in a hot and heavy subject, like radio radiation. That's always a hot one. KC2WGB, are these geniuses that send you these emails and whatever, communications, are they going to stop us again this week, John? KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net, and thanks for dropping by. Yeah, we got a nice little question here from a young amateur. Let me let her drop. This young fella purchased something at a fest of some kind, and it's called a Synad meter. Okay. There's not much in it. It has one VNC connector in the front, a power switch, and a meter. That's it. He'd like to know what it's used for, and if you've ever seen one, and how is it applied to this particular measurement. He's heard of the measurement, but he's not really sure what it is. Maybe you could help him out. Maybe you've seen one of these devices.
Okay, your signal is quite foggy right now, Hal. So anything you can do to increase your power would help. But go right ahead, K60PZ, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
I'm 2KC off. I have to adjust it.
Maybe Hank is, maybe Hal is making a change to his equipment. So while he's doing that, I'll tell you the way FM equipment used to be measured in sensitivity. In the old days, you recognize the fact that when no signal is present and your audio is not being squelched off, you've got the squelch wide open, as they say, you would hear quite a bit of hiss. And there's a good reason for that. The frequency discriminator really is a kind of a differentiator. So it tends to emphasize high-frequency noise, hiss, for instance. As you start putting in a carrier, just a dead carrier with no modulation in the center of the channel, and you start off with a very weak carrier and slowly increase it, you'll notice that the noise output from your radio, an FM radio, starts becoming more and more quiet. And in the old days, 20 decibels of quieting used to be the definition of sensitivity. It's still a pretty good definition today. It has its slight problems, but in my opinion, 20 decibels of quieting is a good way to measure sensitivity. When it comes to commercial equipment, which has to be done in a more quantitative manner, let me drop. Your signal is about 80% noise, Hank. Hal, I'm not sure we're going to be able to hear you, but anything you can do to increase your signal strength back to the way it was 20 minutes ago would certainly be helpful. Nowadays, we worry about how clean is the audio? Is there audio distortion? Is the system making harmonics of the voice, for instance? And so therefore, the SINAD test, signal to noise end distortion, is what SINAD sort of stands for. I may have the acronym a little bit screwed up, but it is a piece of electronics where typically it puts a 1 kilohertz FM modulation on the signal generator that's doing the testing. The receiver of a SINAD test is looking for the 1 kilohertz note, so that as you increase the signal strength from 0 up to what you believe is the sensitivity of the radio, the noise in the background becomes quieter, the distortion becomes less, and when the signal-to-noise ratio plus distortion equals 12 decibels to the good, that's the modern-day equivalent of a SINAD test. It's a more stringent test than simple 20 dB of quieting. So the complete chunk of electronics that does a SINAD test is, in general, it looks a little bit like a signal monitor set, if you know what I mean, like a station master, not a station master. I can't think of the name of the service monitor is the word I'm looking for. Thank goodness I'm not getting old-timers disease. Yes, service monitor is a pretty elaborate piece of electronics that does the right signal generation and has all the electronics to look for that 1KC node and measure 12 dB of signal-to-noise ratio plus distortion, if you know what I mean. So, a simple little box
repeater. Time out.
A simple little...
Better not. CP3.
A simple little box with a BNC connector on the front of it that says SINAD tester. It sounds to me like it's a subset of the service monitor that's usually used to do this. Maybe there's something more simple that I don't know about. So let's see if Hal's got to say about this. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
RIW in TechNet, K6DPZ. Okay, chances are you found something made by helper instruments. It's a SINAD meter. And the one thing a SINAD meter will do where a 20 dB quieting measurement would not do, when you do a 20 dB quieting measurement, you're tuning the center frequency and you're injecting a carrier for 1/10 of the audio. You have audio, you knock it down where it's 1/10 of the audio. And so at one specific frequency, your carrier is going through from your generator. In the SINAD test, you're doing a modulated signal. And if there's a discrepancy in the bandpass of the FM receiver, you will not get your 12 dB SINAD reading. So SINAD measurement is a much complex measurement to see how the overall response of the receiver is with a given bandwidth. How's that, Richard? K2RW, K6DPZ.
Whatever you did, Hal, to increase your signal strength worked like a charm. You were 80% noise before, and that time you were essentially dead full quieting. And the one thing that Hal maybe didn't quite make clear is that when he said you tuned for 1/10 signal, what he really means is 1/10 of the voltage going to the loudspeaker, so to speak, happens to be 1/100th of the power. 1/100th of power is 20 dB. So whether you call it a 10-to-1 voltage change or 20 decibels of quieting, it's the exact same measurement. Hal used the voltage requirement of 1/10th of voltage of RMS, so to speak. But one of the reasons I think that a 12 dB SINAD test was created is that I could build a chunk of electronics that passes the 12 dB of quieting test, and yet it would be not very useful. If I made myself an extremely narrow IF bandwidth and had some kind of a sloppy frequency discriminator connected to it, if I took an unmodulated carrier, let me drop. I took an unmodulated carrier, put it into the center of that channel, slowly turned up the amplitude on that modulated carrier until the noise coming out of your FM receiver got quieter by 10-to-1 in voltage, 20 decibels in signal strength. I would make a nice measurement. But because my IF strip is so narrow, in my example, because the discriminator is tuned off to one side and it's sloppy and it's got some distortion, if I put real FM modulated audio into that radio that just did a beautiful job of passing your 20 dB of quieting test, it might really sound pretty yucky. So that the 12 dB SINAD test goes the next step of taking a real 1 kHz FM modulated signal of the right amount of modulation deviation, and it's now looking for not quieting, it's looking for 12 dB of signal-to-noise ratio of that 1KC node that your signal generator, your 12 dB SINAD signal generator just generated. So it's a much more stringent test, and as such, you have a lot more confidence in the measurement you make that way, and that's why it's the new standard, new meaning for the last 20 years. 20 dB of quieting, I think that sort of fell out of favor probably more than 20 years ago. Am I right on that one, Hank? Guy Mahal, K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
RIW in TechNet, K6DPZ. You're right, Richard. Yeah, the SINAD measurement is a better measurement for FM. And my feeling, you can even use a SINAD type measurement when you're checking sensitivity on single sideband if you play it the right way. But we're not going there. You know, 20 dB quieting has been a standard for many years, and it's 1/10. You have, let's say, 1 volt output across the voice coil, drop it down to 0.1 volts, 1/10, with the carrier coming in, it's 20 dB. But now a SINAD meter is a lot handier, and it's
more accepted in the industry, but you have to know the amount of deviation you're working with when you utilize a SINAD meter from the bandwidth of the receiver you're working with. Go ahead, Tech.
And that's another very good point that Hank just brought up, Hal just brought up, and that is these new FCC mandated radios, in theory, that mandate supposedly went into effect January of 2013, where all commercial radios are now supposed to be something like 2.5 kc of deviation when they used to be 4.5. And so the FCC, with that new law, thinks that they're going to get twice as many channels and a lot more people can use the radio spectrum. And so when you buy Baofeng and Waxong radios that are manufactured in the last year or so, when they're in the so-called wideband mode, according to the menu, you're really putting out plus or minus 2.4 kc, roughly. And so it's going to sound very low in audio. It's roughly half the amount of deviation. And by the way, it's got a wideband and narrowband menu. When you go to the narrowband menu of the new radios, you get 1.25 instead of the 2.5, which is too narrow by ham radio purposes. When you go to half the deviation, you get one-half the audio voltage, which is 1/4 of the audio power, because power is a function of voltage squared. So you're 6 or 7 dB down, and so it's going to sound kind of quiet. So when we amateurs buy Baofengs and Waxongs, let me drop them. It's very tempting because they got extremely good prices. Dual band radio for, you know, $49, so to speak, and a single band radio for like $19. It's hard to turn it down, but it really is a commercially made radio that happens to also cover the ham radio frequencies. And so you'll find on the internet all kinds of suggestions as to how to increase the deviation of that radio that you now buy for ham radio purposes, by drilling a bigger hole in front of the microphone and making various electronic changes to increase the amount of audio in that radio. And the further confusion is the exact same model numbers of Baofengs and Waxongs made 2 or 3 years ago before the new FCC mandate were not narrowband. So just because you've got the right model number, you think the problem goes away. It's a function of whether you bought a 3-year-old radio or a 6-month-old radio. The exact same model number can have different deviations because of those crazy FCC changes. So the 12 dB SINAD measurement, as Hank was, as Hal was telling you, yeah, if it was set up for 2.5 kc of, on a radio, and you put 4.5 kc of FM standard into it, in theory, you're going to get a crazy different answer. So nothing is simple. Hopefully this helps a little bit, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
DP0, one more comment before I bounce out of here.
You got it, Hal.
Okay, on most pieces of equipment, if you're going to go narrower in bandwidth, you have to redesign the pre-emphasis in the transmitter audio system and the de-emphasis in the receiver's audio system to take up the difference of the drop in bandwidth. Dick, you can explain it. I'm out of here. K6DPZ clear.
If you were building a state-of-the-art radio for commercial service that runs on 2.5 kc of deviation, you've got a more narrow IF bandpass filter. You've got a discriminator with a steeper curve to it of voltage versus frequency deviation. In theory, it takes a complete redesign to do it correctly. Hal was also telling us about the pre-emphasis and de-emphasis network. However, I have reason to believe that the new Baofengs, with the new FCC-mandated frequency narrow banding, use the exact same IF bandwidth, the exact same discriminator. They just turned down the audio, so to speak, in the way they burned the integrated circuit chip that is the radio transmitter in there. It's an integrated circuit chip, which is a burn once type. It's not an EEPROM. So there's no easy way of resetting that chip. And they did not redesign the IF strip and discriminator in order to accommodate for best performance. So it's a mixture, as you can tell. The good news is you're getting a lot of radio for the dollars. The bad news is you're getting a radio that's very hard to program, and because of the narrowbandness of its transmitter, it doesn't sound so good in some cases. K6DPZ, here we go, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
just want to make sure we keep the 375 running, Dick. Okay, very good. At least he knows what it was for and how it's used, and that may give him some reason to find out how he can use it, if he can. But hey, for $10, it can go wrong, that's for sure. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the second one. Okay, this amateur has purchased a RF generator. It's not synthesized. It's a good quality generator. He burnt out the attenuator pot. The potentiometer has three wires hooked to it. He has no idea of the value of the pot. He took the carbon element out and thought he could measure it. Doesn't know if it's tapered or not, and he'd like to replace it. So he'd like to know, what does he have to be careful of, and how should he go about establishing a value that will be sufficient. You know, he's just using it for signal testing, so he doesn't need a calibrated output, but he'd like to be able to have a good variable on the RF output, of course. So maybe you could help him out with that, KC2WGB. Back to you.
I say one comment before I shut the power off.
Corinne, head help.
What model generator is it? If I know, if I have a diagram, I can tell him what the replacement pot would be. We have a large library of test equipment.
I don't know the model number, but it's a Polar.
Yeah, I didn't get that, John.
John, repeat what you just said, and go a little slower.
Okay. I don't have a model number, but it's a Polar.
Polar may use a changing voltage on its buffer amplifier as compared to using a low impedance pot in the output. So if it's got V plus voltage on those leads of that pot, chances are it could be a 25K pot and it'll be able to get this variable output. That's why I'm asking. If he has DC voltages on those leads, then it's changing the V plus voltage going to the circuit.
Hal, I don't believe so because its output goes directly to the RF output port. It's not a BNC connector. I think it's a C connector that's on this unit.
Yeah, then put a 100 ohm pot on the output and have a range of swing, I would say. What do you say, Dick?
Yeah, in my opinion, a 100 ohm pot, a 500 ohm pot, a 50 ohm pot, a 1,000 ohm pot, the exact value of the pot is not so stringent a requirement. Let me show you why. A real good signal generator, like a Hewlett-Packard 608 in the old days, had a piston attenuator where each centimeter of movement of a piston would give you an extremely accurate number of decibels of change, and yet the output of the attenuator stayed 50.0 ohms of impedance throughout 99% of that range. To use a simple potentiometer as the output as the RF amplitude adjuster has a huge number of disadvantages. Let me drop.
Dick, you're talking about a waveguide below cutoff attenuator. Explain what it is.
The main point I'm making, Hal, I didn't want to get too complicated on this one, is that when you use a potentiometer to adjust RF amplitude, when you're down at the bottom of the potentiometer range, because you want a very small signal, you're down at the bottom of the range where the impedance of the signal generator is very close to 0 ohms. If it was a 500 ohm pot, when you're up at the top of the pot for maximum signal, you're a 500 ohm signal generator, and everything in between, you're changing the impedance. So it's not, in my opinion, a good design of a signal generator. The rest of the signal generator may be gold-plated, but if the...
Wasn't that the capacitive component was usually used to regulate capacitive reactance and to actually...
What I think you're trying to say, Wes, is that if this was a potentiometer that had a whole bunch of taps on it, and you put the right kind of network in between those taps, you can correct some of this problem that I'm describing. But it was described to us as a three-terminal round potentiometer-type device adjusting the RF output that kind of a simple circuit. There's no easy way of making it have a constant 50 ohm impedance as you would go through the amplitude range. So that's what I'm getting at, is using any old potentiometer there is going to get you approximately back to where you were. Where you were is a marginal design, in my opinion, of a signal generator by modern day standards. This is a signal generator that is very non-constant in output impedance as you adjust the amplitude. And so that could at times give you some slightly confusing results when you're trying to, say, for instance, measure the sensitivity of a receiver. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
DPZ with a comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Hal.
Take a 50-ohm pot. Take the high side of the pot, go out to the output. Take the low side, go to the ground. Take the wiper, put a 100-ohm resistor in series with the wiper, and you'll have a little linearity with a 50-ohm output on the pot on the high end.
Never going to reach the lower end because you're going to always have a 100-ohm. They could never be smaller. So, yeah, it's a compromise. And to XJN.
So what happens for XJN, remember that input to that pot's going to be all the way near the bottom. Its 50-ohm impedance is going to appear across the whole pot. Over.
Got it. John.
Now, what Hal was telling us is a way of partially getting around the problem of a continuously changing impedance out of a potentiometer used in the conventional way. Hal was telling us that there is a way of partially negating that problem by using the potentiometer used as sort of the other way around, if you know what I mean. Now, the variation of impedance is less, but still there is a variation of impedance. Better made signal generators have, in order to try to avoid this problem, they usually do it by having a amplifier in the final stage that can put out a lot more power than required. The output of that amplifier goes through, say, a 10 decibel high power attenuator. Now, all signals that you look at have been coming through that 10 dB 50 ohm attenuator. And now when you go from maximum signal to minimum signal on that kind of a system, you probably change from 49 to 51 ohms, if you know what I mean. It's very close to a constant impedance output. And on top of that, it avoids another problem. Let me drop. And that is, if the device that you're testing has an input standing wave ratio that's anything above 1:1, and some signal is being reflected, and if that signal being reflected back toward the signal generator is not being thoroughly absorbed because the signal generator doesn't present an output impedance of exactly 50 ohms resistive, then that signal that doesn't get absorbed at the signal generator gets re-reflected forward, and as you sweep in frequency, the length of your cable from the test equipment to the device on the test becomes a quarter wave, half wave, resonant, and you get some funny characteristics. By the way, if you see the March issue of QST Magazine, which is the so-called antenna issue, there's a beautiful article in there by Joel Harris, I think that's his name, the guy who writes the articles, the doctor is in, a beautiful article showing you a bunch of diagrams of what's really happening with standing wave ratio. Let me drop. There's a tremendous number of misunderstandings on a standing wave ratio measurement, or when you're using a bird directional watt meter. It turns out that when you're using something like an antenna tuner, which always corrects the impedance that your transmitter sees, your source of signal sees, if it's properly used, and no matter how high the standing wave ratio of your antenna is on the other end of the feed line, you're always, in that case, going to have some amount of reflected energy. With proper use of the antenna tuner, all of the energy reflected back down the line gets re-reflected forward, every bit of it. And then it's re-reflected forward, not just re-reflected completely, but it's re-reflected in such a way that it's in phase with the energy that's coming out of the transmitter at this time. As such, when you're using your antenna tuner, and at the output of the antenna tuner, you put a bird watt meter, a directional power meter, you're always going to read more power than reality if there's any viswire in that system. He gave an example of how a 100-watt transmitter will, with its bird directional power meter, read 150 watts of apparent forward power. and 25 watts of reverse power. You'd be amazed how many people will scoff at that, saying the 150 watts of indicated forward power is only reactive power. They'll scoff at it and say it's not real. The meter is lying to you. Turns out the meter is telling the gospel truth. When you get down to the bottom of what's really going on, whenever you've got any real visual in that system, you're going to read more forward power than your signal generator is really generating.